Hey, it's 12:30 in America and 7:30 in Israel, where Rabbi Dr. Ari Zivotofsky is. A pleasure to welcome him back to Torah in Motion. And Rabbi Dr. Ari is a professor of neuroscience at Bar-Ilan University. He's just coming back from teaching, actually, and of course is one of the founders of the Masorah dinners, where they eat all these exotic animals and discovering kosher animals, and has an interest as he called halachic adventures. And I guess I want to wish Ari a mazel tov that his son recently became the first person to be born in Jerusalem, Israel, officially. His son's, I think, 19 years old or so. But for many years, he's been fighting to have his son recognized on a passport. His case went all the way to the Supreme Court of the United States, and twice to the Supreme Court of the United States, okay? And just about 2 weeks ago, it was announced that his son can have a passport, Jerusalem, Israel. So I want to give you a mazel tov on that, if I may. Okay, I'm Akasha. Dr. Ari, we're looking forward to a turkey-type shear. Okay, let's go.
Okay, so I see that we have a lot of people here from Israel and from Canada. And in both places, today's a regular work day. But if I understand that in the United States of America, at least still it's a holiday. Who knows what's going to happen now with the far leftists that are taking over. But the holiday is celebrated usually by eating a turkey dinner. And the question is turkey a kosher bird? That's what I'd like to talk about. But in order to talk about is turkey a kosher bird, we're going to start off by discussing the kashrut of exotic birds and how we determine which fowl are kosher and which are not. Okay, you see the PowerPoint?
Okay. It's all in blue. Merida Tarnagolim, kashrut shalafotya.
Okay, so we're going to talk about exotic birds, and then we're going to get to the turkey, which for most people today is not exotic. And actually, it's worth pointing out, even though it's a holiday in America when they eat turkey today, they only eat turkey on holidays. Here in Israel, we eat it all the time, and Israel is actually the number one consumer of turkey per capita in the world, far and above most other countries. I don't remember the latest numbers, but I think it's more than 50% more than the U.S., which is way above any other country. We just here in Israel don't eat it as whole turkeys the way you do on Thanksgiving, but in shawarma and in other fashions. So turkey is very very widely eaten in Israel. Okay, how do we know which birds are kosher? So the Torah twice repeats the laws of kashrus in Parsha Shmini and in Parsha Re'eh. And both times regarding birds, all that we have is a list of those birds that are not kosher. And the lists are more or less identical. It's 20 birds in one, 21 in the other. Some of them have after them, limina, to meaning their species or expanded list, which the Talmud tells us means there are a total of 24 non-kosher types of birds. And by implication, everything else is kosher. Meaning in the time of Moshe, Moshe comes down with the Torah, tells the Jews, these you shall eat, these you shouldn't eat. When it comes to birds, he just said, these you shall not eat. And now if anybody comes to him with another bird and they say, is this bird kosher or not kosher? All they would have had to do is look at the list, compare that bird to the list, and if the bird is not on the list, it's a kosher bird. Well, we might think we could try that today as well. Now, as all of you in North America know, if you want an authoritative translation of any Jewish source, we just go to Art Scholar. So here we go to the Art Scroll translation of the Chumash. And it tells us, these shall you abominate from among the birds. They shall not be eaten. They are an abomination. The Nesher, the Paris, the Ozniah, the Da'ah, and the Ayah. And we see that the translation is not much of a translation. It's more of a transliteration. Meaning, you come to this list with your bird, and I know what the bird is in English, and now I want to know, is it kosher? And I want to compare it to the list. I can't do that really so well because they haven't translated anything for me. Now, you might think that Art Scroll was just copping out. It turns out they're not the first one to do this. If you go back 150 years before Art Scroll, you'll find out that Rav Samson Raphael Hirsch did the same thing. Rav Samson Raphael Hirsch, when he translated the Torah into German, you see over here the Da'a on the Ya'a Ya'a. Yudin Oreb. I can't read most of these, both the font and the language, but you can see clearly there's no translation. The Kos and the Shalach, he did the exact same thing as Art Scroll. So although I could see on Rabbi Jay's face when I showed the Art Scroll that he was Mark Koizik from the Art Scroll, but what's he going to do? Because he likes Rav Hirsch. And Rav Hirsch did the same thing. And why did Rav Hirsch do it? And why did Art Scroll do it? Because they understand that this list could have halakhic significance. Meaning, if I have a bird and I now want to use the biblical method of identifying a kosher bird, what I would do is compare it to the list. And if it's not on the list, it's kosher. But now if I have my translation into German, and in the mid-19th century, a German Jew wants to know if a new bird is kosher, he would come and look at Rav Hirsch's translation, and if it's not on the list, he might think it's kosher. And Rav Hirsch wants to avoid any such possibilities. Even though, as we'll see in a minute, today this list has no halakhic significance, we don't use it anymore. Nonetheless, in order to avoid such a potential pitfall, Rav Hirsch and Art Scroll chose not to translate, but rather to transliterate the list so that there wouldn't be any mistranslations, misidentifications. This was what happened in the biblical period. At some point, some of the identifications of these birds started to be forgotten. And the problem is that a list of exclusion requires that you know every one of those species. How would I know it's kosher? Only if I know it's not on the list. But that means that if even one of these birds I no longer know how to identify, I can no longer exclude my new bird. So when you have a list of exclusions, you need to have positive identification of every one of those birds. So by the time of the Mishnah, Chazal already understood the list wouldn't be good enough, and they gave signs. So the Mishnah tells us, Simone of lo ne'amru. The Torah didn't give us signs for the birds, but Amru Chachamim, the sages did. They told us, call of hadores hamei. Any bird that is a dores, which will translate as a predator, is tamei, tamei meaning non-kosher. V'chol sheyesh lo etz b'yetera, v'zefek, v'korkavon o'niklaf, tohor. Any bird that has an extra finger, extra toe, it has a crop, and it has a gizzard in which the inside layer can be peeled out, a kosher. So the Mishnah has given us one negative sign and three positive signs. If it's a predator, it's not kosher. If it has an extra toe, if it has a crop, and it has a peelable gizzard, it is kosher. Now, really, it would seem that if it's such simple list and such simple signs, why the Torah didn't give them? And I have no answer. Why did the Torah give just the list and not the signs? I don't know. But the rabbis, Chazal and the Mishnah, gave us these signs. It bothered Tosfos. If the Torah didn't give the signs, how could the rabbis possibly have given these signs and been certain that it's not going to lead to an error? How could they know that their observation was so perfect that they could give us physical signs that then would identify the kosher birds? And so Tosfos was bothered by it, and Tosfos said it can't be that they did it just on observation, and he postulates that there had been an oral tradition going back to the days of Noah, who had been able to identify every kosher and non-kosher species. Okay, so it seems we have this list. Great. So today I want to know if turkey is kosher. What do? I now don't look at the list for the Torah. I look instead at the signs for the Mishnah. Well, how do I apply these signs to turkey or to any other new bird, pheasant or guinea fowl or any other exotic bird? So first of all, we need to know what these things mean. What's a dores? What's an etz b'yetera? And unfortunately, by the time of the Rishonim, by the medieval rabbis, we already had lots of debate how to use these, what these signs mean. So for example, what's a dores? What's a predator? Well, Rashi says a dores means ha'ochez b'tzipanov u'magbia min ha'karka ma she'ochel. He holds down his feet with his foot. He holds down his food. So he holds down his food with his foot, and he then picks it up with his beak and eats it. Now, this definition bothered Tosfos very much, because Tosfos said, we all know that chickens are kosher. That nobody has ever argued about. Well, at least until very recently, when there was a huge debate here in Israel about certain breeds of chickens. But until very recently, nobody questioned the kashrut of chicken. And yet Tosfos says, According to this definition of Rashi, a chicken would seem to be a dores, a predator. Here's just an example of a dores, captures food. And so Tosfos gave a different answer. Tosfos says that Rabbeinu Tam said, what's a dores? Dores v'ochel michayim v'eino mamten lad shetamut. That a predator is a bird that eats its prey while the prey is still alive. And then I guess Tosfos felt chickens don't do. But those aren't the only explanations. Rambam, Maimonides, gives another explanation. First, he gives a way to recognize it from the Mishnah, and then he says, "Shekolet min avir v'ochel ba'avir." He catches his bird, that catches his prey while in flight, and eats the prey while he's still flying. And Ramban gives a different answer. Ramban says, "What's a predator? Shuat tzatzayid v'horeg otam b'makat drisa shedoreis b'tzipanav." He kills its prey with its toenails. So we have a wide diversity here of what it means, dores. So if we want to use these signs that we find in the Mishnah, we have to somehow know at least what it means, predator. Okay, maybe the other signs are easier. What does it mean, an extra toe? Even for an extra toe, we have a debate between Ran, the Rabbeinu Nissan, the Ran, and Rashi. Rashi says that the extra toe, Zu etzba hagavoa shachar etzbot, the extra toe that's behind the other toes. Meaning, according to Rashi, in this picture, you have these toes in the front, and this toe in the back is the extra toe, according to Rashi. The Ran says, no, that's not an extra toe. Extra toe means mishlosha ha'etzbot ha'kdumot ha'emtsa'it arukayot ha'mayashar, that among the three forward-facing toes, the middle one is extra long, like you see over here. You see that middle toe is longer than all the others. So according to Ran, that's what it means, etzbiatera. So again, we have a problem. How do we apply these signs? We don't know what a dores is. We don't know what an etzbiatera is. At least the other signs, maybe we have a better understanding. The zephek, the crop, is the first stage in the digestive system of the birds. Here's the crop. Most of the time, the birds that we're going to eat are not the predators, but the prey. An animal that's prey for other animals needs to eat quickly and then go find someplace to hide. So chickens and other kosher birds eat a lot of their food. They store it in the crop, like a storage pouch at the very beginning of the digestive system. And then they go and they go to a safe place and they digest the food. So that's relatively simple. A bird with a crop, that's one of the three positive signs of a kosher bird. Here's an example of the crop, and you can see you can blow it up. It could store a lot of grain in it. And what is kuk of a niklaf, a peelable gizzard? The gizzard is the pipik. The pipik that they serve in yeshivas, that's the kurkavan. And here you see a kurkavan right out of the animal. And by a peelable gizzard, it means that the inner membrane is peelable. The gizzard is the last stop in the digestive system, meaning that it holds all of the waste that's about to be expelled. And it's really just a muscular sac that's then going to contract and expel the waste. So when you take the gizzard out of a slaughtered chicken, it's a muscular pouch full of lots of waste material. And in a kosher bird, there's an inner lining, almost like a garbage bag, which just is easily peelable out, and then you're left with a clean piece of meat. So that's what it means, korkova niklaf. So we now have at least two of the four signs, we know what they are. But let's just go back to the Mishnah a second. And the Mishnah gave us signs. The Mishnah said we don't use the list anymore. Here we have signs. Call over the race tummy. Any bird that's a predator is not kosher. We're not sure what that means. But even before that, how do we use this list? For a bird to be kosher, does it have to have all four signs, meaning it's not a predator and it has etzbiatera, zephek, and kork of a niklaf? Or maybe the three positive signs are an indication that it's not a predator. Or maybe one of these signs is more significant than the other. The Rambam gives a lot more significance to a peelable gizzard. So for that, we have a debate among the Rishonim as well. How do we use the signs? What do each of the signs mean? So it could be that in the time of the Mishnah, in the time of the Talmud, they knew how to use the signs and they used the signs to identify a kosher bird. However, that period ended a long time ago. Just here's a gizzard with the membrane peeled out. You see it's a thin membrane. Everything is taken out with it, and you're left with a clean piece of meat. And here is a Kurkovan from an ostrich. We did an experiment. We were down. We wanted to see if the ostrich Kurkovan would kill. Okay. By the end of the Talmudic era, these signs weren't serving their purpose, because the Talmud tells very cryptically a story, which Rashi then elaborates on. The Talmud tells us, "Kamen Golsa d'Agma," some kind of bird, Asira. It's prohibited. Why is it prohibited? Because Chazua d'Darsa v'Ochla, they saw that it was a predator. What's going on here? So Rashi tells us. Rashi says that Ruach HaChomim should doresh it v'Ochelet. They saw that it was a predator and it would eat. And what happened is that nearly the of habalafanenu yesh lomar shema yidros. Any new bird that comes to us, any bird that we're not familiar with, we have to be concerned that maybe it's a predator. Why? Daha hachtanag also the agma. This particular bird, hayu machzikin betahara, they used to eat it. Meaning the Talmudic rabbis had ruled that this Tanagosa da'agma is permitted, and Jews in whatever region were eating it. And then what happened was, la'achazman ru'usho doreset. They saw that it was a predator. And therefore, as the Talmud says, they prohibited it. So Rashi is telling us an amazing story. In the Talmudic period, we're dealing with rabbis from the Talmud who found a new bird, or a bird that they weren't so familiar with. They decided that this bird is permitted, and they let people eat it. And then as they observed the behavior of this bird, they realized that it was a predator, and they turned around and they prohibited the bird. Based on that, Rashi says we can no longer use the signs that are found in the Mishnah. Rashi says any bird that we're not familiar with, we have to be concerned it might be a predator. And therefore, ein of ne'achal lanu el b'msoret. The only way we could permit a bird today is with a tradition. And therefore, and what does that mean? Shemasu lanu avotenu b'tohar, that we have from our ancestors that it's a kosher bird. Vishalom masu lanu, if they haven't given us a tradition, yesh lochush, we have to be concerned it's a predator. Uva mesoret, with a tradition, yesh lanu l'smoch, we could rely on that. So what Rashi is saying is that you can't permit a bird based on the list in the Torah. You can't permit a bird based on the signs in the Mishnah. The only way to know if a bird is kosher, you come upon a bird that you're not sure about, you have to bring it to your grandmother and say, Safta, did we eat this bird? And the only way that we could permit birds is when your teacher, when your grandparent tells you that this bird is a kosher bird. Now, what that means is that whatever there was in a particular generation, if there were X number of birds that are kosher, in the following generation, the number of kosher birds that we're going to have is either X or less than X. You can't, in theory, create a Mesorah. Mesorah means that the previous generation told you it was kosher. Now, this is what Rashi wrote in the 11th century, the early 12th century. What did the halacha determine? Well, if we jump to the Shulchan Aruch, written in Sfat in the 16th century, the authoritative source of halacha for most Jews, and in particular the Sfaradim, when the Ramah argues, and we'll see in a minute where the Ramah disagrees over here, the Shulchan Aruch brings everything that we've talked about till now. First, he starts and says that in the Torah there are 24 species that are not kosher. Everything else was kosher. Then he brings us the signs that we read in the Mishnah, and he elaborates on the signs a little bit. And then at the very end, he says, you can see the second to last line. The af al pi sheyesh lo gimel simanim elu. Even though it has these three signs that we talked about from the Mishnah, ein la'ochlo, you may not eat it. Why? Exactly like Rashi said, l'fi she'anu choshesh in shemahu doreis. We're concerned that this bird is a predator. So how can you eat it? El im ken yesh la mesorot, shemasru lahem avoseihem shuhu tahor. The only way to permit it is with a tradition. And then the Shulchan Aruch says, but you know what? There's one out. There's one case where maybe you could rely on the signs. He says, what is our concern? Our concern is that the bird is a predator. He said, well, what if I know definitively that it's not a predator? How do I know definitively? Because God created this bird in such a way that there's no way it could be a predator. And that's what he says. Yesh omrim, shekolov shechartumo rachav, if it has a wide beak, v'kaf raglo rachava, it has webbed feet, kishel avaz, like a goose, v'yadua she'eno dores, I know that it cannot be a predator, because physically, a goose with a wide beak and a webbed foot can't be a predator. Therefore, mutar b'achila im yesh lo shosh simanim b'gufo, it's permitted if it has the three physical signs. And then that's where the Shulchan Aruch finishes. So the Shulchan Aruch, which is the authoritative work for Sfaradim, says that you must have a tradition to permit a bird unless it has the goose comparison. And the Ramah says, the Ramah, who's the definitive authority for the Ashkenazim, says, V'yesh omrim, she'en l'smoch afilo azeh, v'en l'achol shumof, el l'bemisor, sh'kiblu bo shu tohar, v'cheinogim v'el l'shenos. He says, the Ramah says that Ashkenazim don't even rely on the goose comparison. Even if it has webbed feet and a wide beak, we only eat birds that have a tradition. Okay, so now if I would stop and I would ask for some suggestions of birds that we have a tradition on. Why don't we do that? Can anybody give me some names of birds that we have traditions on today? Okay, maybe we got one in the chat. No.
Chicken.
Okay, we talked about chicken. Chicken, everybody seems to agree. Somebody wrote doves. Doves we have a tradition on. They're not commonly eaten. Somebody else wrote pheasant. We'll talk about pheasant in a moment. Duck, indeed, there are several types
pigeons.
Of ducks.
How about tradition. Pigeons?
Pigeons. So we have quail. Well, we'll talk about that in a minute. Again, geese. There are a few types of geese. And if we leave the chat open for a little longer, maybe we'll get up to 8 or 9 different types of birds. Meaning that today we could probably list 8 or 9 birds that have a tradition that we could transmit to the next generation. Now, in the mid-19th century, a bunch of rabbis realized that just like in academia today, it's publish or perish. If you want to make a name, it's good to write a book. And the rabbis in 19th century Europe and North Africa always were answering questions from the local shochet. And so there are lots and lots of books from the late 18th, early 19th century on Hilchos Shechita. One of them was written by a rabbi in Livorno, Rabbi Yitzchak Cohen, called Zivchei Cohen. And in this book, which was primarily about Shechita and Trefus, he included a list of those birds that he had a Mesorah on. And it wasn't 8 or 9 like we just listed, but rather 30 birds. And here you see a diagram that he drew showing the 30 birds that he said that he had a tradition. He even had students color many of these pictures. They didn't have color printing, it seems. So we have some editions today of this book that are colored and some that are black and white. And he gave the Italian name, which is really like the Latin name, as well as the Hebrew name of these birds. So he said that in Italy, 200 years ago, he had a tradition on 30 birds. Now, some of these are unmistakable. I mean, sure, you could all tell me what number 7 here is, right? I think everybody recognizes the peacock. And indeed, he gives it the Latin name, peacock, calls it tavas in Hebrew. And the question is, would this be sufficient in order for us to determine that a peacock is kosher? We'll get to that hopefully in a minute. Some of the others here, this is clearly pheasant. Some are easier to identify. Some are harder to identify. You'll notice he doesn't have chicken here and he doesn't have turkey here. Okay, so before we get to the turkey, I want to give you a few examples of some other birds. What happened was we realized about 30 years ago that the entire world of kosher fowl had changed in the last few generations. If you go back 1,000 years or 500 years or 200 years ago, every little town had their own shochet, and every town, all the shechita was local. There was no refrigerated trucks that could take meat for hundreds of miles, meaning that every town in Eastern Europe and every town in North Africa and all the Jews in Yemen and Iraq and Iran, each town had their own shochet, and those shochetim were experts in the local birds, and every town knew which bird was kosher in that region and had probably no clue about other regions. What has happened in the last 200 years is that two things have changed. One is that all of those places which had traditions no longer have Jewish communities. Eastern Europe is essentially empty of Jewish communities. North Africa, other than Jerba and a small community in Morocco, there's almost nothing left. Iraq, there are no Jews left. On the other hand, there were no traditions regarding North American birds, as there was essentially no Orthodox community in North America. And Israel had a very, very small community. Today, the overwhelming majority of the Jewish world is in North America and in Israel. And the second thing that changed drastically is the centralization of food production. As opposed to 200 years ago, when all the shechita was local, today, all the shechita is centralized. And there are plants today that are shechting 80,000 chickens a day, something that was unheard of 200 years ago. And you could have a shechit who's working in a plant like that, who shechts over his career millions of chickens and shechts nothing but chickens. Unlike what existed 200 years ago, where unquestionably the shechit knew the local birds. We realized this a little bit late for most of the Eastern European shochtim, where essentially the communities were gone by the time of the Holocaust. But for the North Africans, they left North Africa more in the 50s and 60s. So we decided to try to look for some of these traditions. One of them that we looked for was traditions on the pininia, on the guinea fowl. And here you see you have Mahmoud, me and my chavrusa Ari Greenspan, who I did this work with many years ago, holding guinea fowl. And what we did was, okay, let's see if the video now works. Okay, what I have here, we put together a video of a few of these older rabbis that we interviewed and asked them about various birds. Okay. Okay, hold on. See if this works. Okay, most of it's in Hebrew, so I'll narrate on top of it. Here we went to visit.
ואתה זוכר ששחטו את זה?
כן, אני שחטתי את זה.
אתה שחטת את זה. יפה, שחטת את זה. זה
באלג'ריה, באתנה.
בעיירה באתנה.
באתנה.
כן.
זה לא רחוק מקונסטנטין.
מה קוראים לה? פיפיה.
פניניה.
Okay, so this is just to give a demonstration what we did. We went around to these various communities looking for traditions. Okay, back to the PowerPoint. And Rav Mahmoud told us that he has a tradition on it. And here you see Rav Mahmoud examining the bird, taking out the gizzard and the crop. Okay, so now we get to turkey. We now have the principles. The principle is very straightforward, that we had a list originally of non-kosher birds. We no longer use it. We had signs in the Mishnah. We no longer use them. The principle is very simple. Ashkenazim and Sfardim, the only way we know which birds are kosher are if we have a tradition, a Masorah. And now the problem with turkey. Where is turkey from? Turkey is a New World bird, meaning it made it to Europe at the very, very beginning of the 16th century. It spread very quickly around Europe to the point that Shakespeare in Twelfth Night mentions the turkey, but it spread around Europe quickly, and it seems the Jews even started eating it. The problem is that there is no way that there could have been a tradition about the turkey. The turkey simply did not exist in Europe until the 16th century. So how is it that the turkey is a kosher bird if we only eat birds based on tradition? Okay, I guess we could ask, you know, time's running. We're not going to open it to suggestions. Let me give you some of the answers that have been proposed. But first, what's fascinating is in the 16th and 17th century, as far as I could find, there are no responsa with questions to the rabbi that says, is turkey kosher? Simply nobody asked it. By the 17th century, there are questions regarding trefot in Turkey, meaning the Jews were eating turkey, and they're asking questions about the defects that were found in the turkey, and is it kosher? But nobody in the 16th or 17th century asked, is turkey kosher? In the 18th and 19th century, we start getting a different type of question. We start getting the question of, why is turkey kosher? Meaning by that point, it's a given that the turkey is kosher, and the questioners are asking the rabbinic authorities, why? How could it be that the turkey is a kosher bird? And the answers that were given, some of them are problematic, and some of them could shed light on how the poskim understood the parameters of which birds are kosher. So, for example, some people will tell you, and this one is not in the poskim, but this one many people suggest, is that obviously the turkey is kosher. The turkey is a New World bird. And if it's a New World bird, it couldn't have been on the biblical list. And after all, that's where it all started. There's 24 non-kosher birds in the Tanakh, in the Chumash. Any bird not on that list is kosher. Obviously, the turkey as a bird from North America could not have been on that list. That answer is fallacious because that list wasn't 24 species in the modern definition of species, but 24 categories of birds, such that if you had brought the American eagle or the American types of vultures to Moshe Rabbeinu, he would have told you, obviously, that vulture is a predator and it falls under the category of this and this bird in the list, meaning the 24 broad categories. And clearly, there are North American predators that would not be kosher and would have been in one of those categories on the list. So to say the turkey, New World, couldn't have been on the list doesn't work. Some people, and unfortunately, this includes some of the best books on Masechet Chulin, mention another suggestion. They say, no problem. Turkey, New World, we know, they say, that some of the 10 lost tribes were in South America, and they were eating turkey, and we rely on the tradition of the 10 tribes who were in South America. That answer I find to be very troubling. I don't know how they know who the 10 tribes in South America were. I don't know how they know that there were 10 lost tribes in South America, and I don't know why you would assume that they were still keeping the laws of kosher. There are some who suggested, and this is in the 18th century, they thought the turkey was not New World, but it was from India, hence the Hebrew name Tanugal Hodu. They thought that it was from India, and there was a Jewish community in India, and therefore we rely on the tradition of the Jews of India. Unfortunately, that answer is found in some of the halakhic literature. And by the way, just to point out, some people like to make the connection. The bird is called Tanugal Hodu, the chicken from India, because they thought it came from India, and it's eaten on Thanksgiving. And they say that in Hebrew, thanks is Hodu. It's important to just point out totally different roots. The word for giving thanks is Lahodot, and Tanugal Hodu, the word from India, is from the root of Hindi with a nun in it. And so the Dalid in Hodu in the name India has a dagesh in it for the missing nun. And therefore, Hodu as India and Hodu as to give thanks are two totally different words. Okay, other people suggest that maybe the turkey snuck in to the Ashkenazi European diet via the Spanish traders and the Sephardim. And they want to say that Sephardim didn't need a Masorah. The Sephardim relied on the simonim, on the physical signs. They started eating it, and then the Ashkenazim relied on them. As you all know by now, that's obviously not true, because the Sephardim also need a Masorah. The Machaber, the Shulchan Aruch, was very clear that the Sephardim also rely only on a tradition. Okay, so what are some of the possible answers of why the turkey is kosher and how it snuck in? So one possible answer given by an important 19th century authority is that it could be that although the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah require absolutely a tradition, and the Ramah with nothing other than a tradition, even with birds that have web feet and a wide beak. It could be that we don't paskin like that. It could be we don't always paskin every single ruling of the Rama, and that indeed the rabbinic authorities in the 16th and 17th century were more lenient regarding accepting new birds. So it could be not that it's stuck in by the Sfardim, or, but rather that there were rabbis who didn't paskin like the Rama in this. There are other 19th century authorities who say, nope, had the turkey get in, the turkey is just a big chicken. It's a big, funny-looking chicken. That answer opens a Pandora's box, because the turkey and the chicken are really not very closely related. If you're going to let the chicken in the door let the turkey in the door via the chicken Masorah, you've now opened the Pandora's box, which lets you let in lots of other birds, including the guinea fowl and the pheasant and lots of other birds that are more closely related to the chicken. Others have said, you know why a turkey is permitted? Because the exact reason why we need a tradition. The reason we need a tradition is because we're concerned that maybe it's a predator. What the Aruga Sabosim said at the beginning of the 20th century is that we have been observing the turkey for hundreds of years, and he only requires 12 months, by the millions of birds. And we know that a turkey is definitively not a predator. And therefore, the Aruga Sabosim says, we could permit a turkey without a tradition because we have no concern that it's a predator. Now, that again opens the Pandora's box, because it means that other birds, if we observe them and we could state definitively that it doesn't answer to any of the criteria of what a doris, a predator, is, then we could also permit that bird. I think that the simplest answer, and the answer that the Netziv gave, is much more fundamental. Before we get to that, I just want to point out, we're asking now again, why the turkey is kosher. We're not asking, is it kosher? Because across the board, Jews have now pretty much accepted turkey. I looked and inquired and have yet to find any kosher organization anywhere in the world, from left to right, that does not certify turkey as kosher. There are individuals who don't eat turkey. For example, the Darkei Tshuva brings down that in the early 19th century, there was the famous Frankel family in Russia, that when you married into the family, you wrote in the ketubah that you were not going to eat turkey. And then there were a few individuals that we know about. Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky had a personal chumrah that he didn't eat turkey. Rav David Lifshitz, the Rosh Yeshiva from YU, it's known that as a personal chumrah, he did not eat turkey. But it was a personal chumrah, and he emphasized to his children, his three daughters, that they don't have to take upon that chumrah. And I spoke to his son-in-law, Professor Waxman, who says, no, they eat turkey, and it was with the blessing of his father-in-law. So it was a personal chumrah of Rav David Lifshitz. So the overwhelming majority of Jews eat turkey. One other exception, descendants of the Shlach have a tradition that the Shlach told his descendants, because there was no Masorah, not to eat turkey. Now, what's amazing is the Shlach wrote huge amounts, and nobody has been able to find any place in the Shlach where he mentioned that in his writings. Nonetheless, the descendants of the Shlach have this tradition, and you can find people who don't eat turkey because they say they're a descendant of the Shlach. But the overwhelming majority of Jews eat turkey. And I think the reason is what the Netziv said. The Netziv said that you want a Masorah in order to permit a bird? I have a Masorah on turkey, the Netziv said. He said, where do I have a Masorah from? My grandparents told me they eat turkey. That's a Masorah. My teachers told me they eat turkey. That's a Masorah. Now you're going to come and start telling me it can't be. Where could the Masorah come from? There was no turkey 500 years ago. The Netziv said, it's not your job to ask what happened 500 years ago. Like the famous story when Hillel was teaching the Ge'er, when the Ge'er wanted to be a Kohen Gadol. And Hillel says, fine, I'll convert you. And he starts teaching him Aleph, Bet, Gimel. And the next day he comes back and Hillel starts telling him Bet, Gimel, Aleph. And the guy says, wait, but yesterday he told me the other way. He said, exactly. You have no outside method of confirmation. You're going to have to rely on what I tell you. And that's how all of Jewish tradition works. You don't ask your teacher, how do you know this is an esrog? He tells you it's an esrog. You have to rely on him that that's an esrog. And that's true with everything, from the Aleph Bet, as Hillel said it, to the non-Jew, to the potential convert, to the most complicated things. Judaism is a mimetic tradition where we rely on the previous generation. You ask the parents and the grandparents and the teachers. And what the Netziv said is you are not obligated to start digging back and saying, but it can't be. If the grandparent told you that the turkey is kosher, the turkey is kosher. You have a Masorah. The burden of proof, the Netziv said, is to now prohibit the turkey, which you can do, meaning that the Tanagolso da Agma was found to be a Doris and they prohibited it. And the Netziv said that if the turkey was found to be, or any other bird, was found to be a Doris, then indeed we would have to reverse the ruling and say it's not kosher. But the burden of proof today is on you to prove it's not kosher, not on me to prove it is kosher, because the Netziv says, I have a Masorah. So the question is, why is the turkey kosher? Well, today the answer is, because we have a tradition. You're going to tell me, but we can't. The answer is, we do. We have a tradition from the previous generations. Now, if you want to do a thesis and try to figure out how it got in, that would be very nice academically, but that's not relevant halachically. Halachically is all I need to know is that I have a tradition. Here are the statistics, actually. I forgot I put these in. Here's in Israel, we eat about 11.5 kilo per year per person. That was in 2016. The U.S. is only 7.8, so we're way ahead of the U.S. And the world average is only 0.8 kilo per year. So Israel is far ahead of the rest of the world. Okay, and just a few other types of birds. And then I want to talk about one other North American bird whose history is very, very different than that of the turkey. The pheasant, the passion, is a very interesting story. That was the first bird that we started to research. As I said, actually, that was probably close to 40 years ago. And when we started researching the story of the pheasant, the first thing we found was that Professor Felix was really one of the experts in biblical and Talmudic flora and fauna. And Professor Felix had an article in the very first volume of the journal Tchumen, where he analyzed the kashrut of the pheasant. And he traced back the word passion all the way to Talmudic literature. And you see that in the Gemara, passion is a kosher bird. And then he traces it through the Rishonim. And you see passion is mentioned even in the Aruch, and it's mentioned in the Rishonim, always as a kosher bird. But the problem is, and this comes back to the question I mentioned about half an hour ago, could the pictures in that book serve as a sort of Masorah? And the answer is no. Masorah means a living tradition. Ish mipi ish. You have to show the bird to a person who could tell you that in my community, we ate this bird. And it's not even enough for him to say, I ate this bird. He has to be reporting a tradition of a community. And what happened with Professor Felix is he traced the passion all the way up to one generation ago. He wasn't able to get that last link. And you need that last link. It needs to be a living tradition, because otherwise we're concerned maybe what the Talmud calls passion is not what we call passion. And indeed, that happened to other species. Tosfos says that what the Talmud called tzvi is not what we today call tzvi. And so names can change. So we sort of said, okay, Professor Felix looked it up. Professor Felix couldn't find that last link. And then we found also a response by Rav Moshe Feinstein. Rav Moshe Feinstein was asked about the pheasant. He said he was not able to find a tradition about the pheasant. Therefore, we have to treat it as non-kosher. So we were pretty much ready to give up. And then we were in the Beis Medrash, Ari Greenspan and myself, in the Gush. And we overheard Sarah Chananel, the guy who we'd become friendly with, talking in the Beis Medrash to a friend of his, not to us. He was reporting to his friend that once a week he would go to the Beis Din of Rav Kapach. And he would report the questions that came to Rav Kapach that week. And he reported that Rav Kapach that week had gotten a question about the kashrut of the pheasant. And Rav Kapach had said that he had a tradition that in Yemen, they used to eat the pheasant. So we tackled him in the Beis Medrash and we said, take us to your leader. And he took us to Rav Kapach. And Rav Kapach said, absolutely. I have a tradition that we ate pheasant in Yemen. But the question is, how do I know that what you're calling passion is what I called passion in Yemen? In order for me to really transmit a tradition to you, I need a pheasant, and I would like that you get two pheasants. You're going to shecht one, and I'm going to shecht one. No problem. This is 40 years ago. We were sort of naive. We went off to the Biblical Zoo, which was much smaller back then. We said, do you guys have pheasants? They said, of course we have pheasants. They showed us the pheasants. And we said, could we buy a pheasant or two? They said, maybe. Why? What do you want the pheasant for? We said, no, we want to take it to a kapach and shecht it. And they threw us out of the zoo as fast as they could. It seems that zoos are not into shechting their animals. They're into preserving their animals. But eventually we found a few pheasants. We brought them to Rav Kapach. And here's Ari Greenspan shechting the pheasant in front of Rav Kapach. And then here's the pheasant in that picture. And there us in front of a pheasant cage. And we got this letter from Rav Kapach. And this is the transmission of Masorah. Rav Kapach writes, Ari Greenspan and Ari Zivotowski from America came to him with a bird, the Fasion. It's in Arabic called this. In Taiman, it's called this. And I know that it's a kosher bird. It has all the kosher signs. V'yesh lanu boi mesoris shuof tohar. We have a tradition that it's a kosher bird. And I've seen great rabbis have shechted it without any question. And therefore, they shechted it in front of me. And the sign on this in Tafshin Membet. Again, there's Rav Kapach confirming the tradition on the bird and transmitting the mesorah to us. Okay, we could talk about a few other mesorahs that we have. One more thing about pheasant, very interesting. This is the Really Jewish Food Guide from London. They publish this every year. I don't know if they still do, but for many years they did. Today, everything is on the internet, but throughout the 20th century and early 21st century, if you wanted to know which foods were kosher, they had this book of several hundred pages telling you what's kosher. And in the introduction to the book, they explained what means kosher. And they told you about meat, and then they told you about the birds. And the Torah lists only the birds which are forbidden to eat, ostrich, owl, vulture. We cannot be sure of their true identity. So by tradition passed down, we know we can eat only poultry such as duck, chicken, goose, and turkey. Pigeon, pheasant, and partridge are also kosher. Fascinating. The United Synagogue in their Jewish Food Guide by the London Besdin says that pheasant is kosher. We contacted the London Besdin. We said, fantastic. We don't have to go out of Kapach. We have a tradition from you. Could we come to you, shech the pheasant in front of you and get a Masorah from you? And the Dayanim looked at this list and they realized that for decades, they haven't looked at the introduction. This had been reprinted year after year and they only dealt with the rest of the book, what was kosher, what they were giving hashkacha certification on. Anyway, if you look at their kosher food guide now, pheasant is not there anymore. They went out. We ended out finding a British shochet who indeed did say he had a masorah on pheasant. We brought him a bird. We gave him this letter. He signed. He said, indeed, my teacher, a shochet actually in Liverpool, said that he had a masorah on pheasant and had shechted pheasant. Here's Rav Machpud. Here's Rav Tendler. Because what happened is, after we got the tradition from Rav Kapach, we wrote a letter to Rav Moshe Feinstein. We said, we have the tradition. In your Igros Moshe, you said you couldn't find a tradition. We got a letter back from his grandson and secretary, who said, you need an oral and visual tradition in order for birds to be kosher. Rav Moshe Feinstein had already told you that without that, it's not kosher. And we were a little intimidated and timid, and it took us a long time to write back. And we said, you misunderstood. We have an oral and visual tradition. But by the time we sent that letter off, Rav Moshe was already not responding, and we never got a response from Rav Moshe. When we told this to Rabbi Tendler, I won't tell you the exact words that he used to describe his son, Rav Moshe's grandson, but let's just say he was disappointed. And he said that he had no question that Rav Moshe would have been willing to rely on the tradition from Rav Kapach. And we said, well, if you're so sure, put your money where your mouth is. And he said, no problem. And that's when we arranged the first halachic suda that we made. We served pheasant, and Rav Tendler indeed ate the pheasant. But I just want to end with a story of another New World bird that had a very, very different trajectory than the story of the turkey. As we saw, the turkey came to Europe very early, was accepted by the Jews almost immediately. And from then, there's been nobody who's questioned the kashrus of the turkey, from right to left, from north to south. The Muscovy duck is very different. The Muscovy duck is found in southern US, Central America, and South America. It means that the Jews didn't right away get it in Europe. And the Jews that then came to New York, Baltimore, New England, Charleston, didn't see it right away. It was only when they started going a little further south that they started seeing the Muscovy duck. And the Muscovy duck is different than all other ducks. All other ducks that we're familiar with are old world ducks. The Muscovy is the only new world, and it's got this little thing up there. It sounds different. It looks a little bit different. And Bernard Illouay was the first one to really address the question. Bernard Illouay was a Hungarian-trained rabbi, left Europe because of politics, not Jewish politics, but he took the wrong side in the elections, and he had to leave Europe. And he made his way to America. He was the first Orthodox rabbi in the U.S. with a PhD, highly educated, but very religious. And that didn't work well in America at the time. He couldn't keep a job. He was rabbi in Baltimore, in Cleveland, in Columbus, in New Orleans. People just didn't want his being makpid on halacha. Anyhow, he found himself in New Orleans. And in New Orleans, he finds that this shechten is going to be duck. And he knows what duck looks like in Europe. And this is not what the duck that he's familiar with looks like. So he said, where do you have the Masorah? And one person points to the next. It's from him. And he says, it's from him. And he points to him. And finally, they end up saying, no, it's the former cantor who now lives in Charleston. And Illouay does a little investigation. And he finds out this cantor is not even Shomer Shabbos. And as far as Illouay is concerned, there's no tradition on this duck. And there can't be. It's a new world bird. So if Illouay says, that's it. In my town, we're not shechting the Muscovy. And the shochet says, well, you might be the rabbi, but I'm the shochet, and I'm shechting the Muscovy. So they had a little bit of a disagreement, and then they both agreed, ki mi Europe teitze Torah. They were going to send a question to some European rabbis. And they sent a letter to Rav Samson Raphael Hirsch and to Rav Natan Adler, the chief rabbi of the British Empire. A phenomenal letter that we can't read the whole thing that one, unfortunately, but it's just an amazing letter. Remember, this is Rav Illouay, Hungarian trained. Hebrew is not his native language. Every sentence is a play on a biblical line. Ki bavoseinu rabim yada et gershtani menachlat avotai al eretz tmeya eretz ochelet yoshveha vanashim kemetim. Beautiful biblical Hebrew. And he then describes, he says, when I came here to New Orleans, he said, I found really a mess. He said, in Achad Shadarashti Pamushan, after my first drasha, more than 40 of the store owners closed their stores on Shabbat that they had been keeping open until then. And then he said, more than 10 families started, that used to eat non-kosher, now kosher their kitchen. Now, he's known as a phenomenal orator. He would speak a ne'ilah and go way after the fast, and nobody would budge. He was a well-known orator, and he says here how he really change things in New Orleans. And then he says, but I have the Muscovy duck. And he writes the whole question. And by the way, he says, till today, you don't have in all of America more than 200 communities, big and small. And you don't have Yoter Me'arba Rabbanim Musmachim. You don't have more than 3 rabbis. Umehem Shlosha Mitamidav Shel Bilam. You hear them of Bilams. Ashenemro Leim V'salachta La'avoni Ki Ravhu. Beautiful. He writes this to the rabbis in Europe. And he gets back from Rabbi Hirsch and from Rabbi Adler. And they both, based on what Rabbi Illouay had written, they both conclude there's no other conclusion they could reach other than that this bird is non-kosher. And from that day forward, the Muscovy duck was non-kosher in the United States. And the question comes up every few decades. However, that wasn't the end of the story. It could be that the Netziv had discussed it. We don't know about that. In 1884, he doesn't give a name. Could be Rabbi Lieberkohn in 1916 discussed it. Also, it's not clear. However, what was fascinating is a few decades later, the Jewish communities in South America started to develop. And there was a Rabbi Goldman who became the rabbi of what was known locally as Moisville, but was known by the Jews as Kiryat Moshe. Baron Hirsch established these farming communities for the Jews in South America in the middle of Pampas. He made a city that the Jews named Kiryat Moshe, 5,000 residents, 98% of them Jewish, and the rabbi was this Rabbi Goldman. They brought him the Muscovy duck. He also said, never saw this bird before. I don't know what the Muscovy duck is. But he understood two things. He and together with another rabbi in South America, Rabbi Taran, they understood Ki Mitzion Teitzei Torah. And they understood that a rabbi can't rule about a bird without seeing the bird. So they sent a pair of Muscovy duck by boat from Argentina to Yerushalayim to ask Rav Shmuel Salant by a Nes Nigla, an absolute miracle. One of the birds actually survived the journey. And they brought the bird to Rav Shmuel Salant, who was a very old man at the time. and he had a visitor, Rav Chaim Berlin, and he said, Rav Chaim Berlin, you decide about this bird if it's kosher. And Rav Chaim Berlin said, I'm not deciding. You're the local rabbi. You're the Moda Asra. You decide. And Rav Shmuel Salant examined the bird. We don't know based on what he decided, but he handed it to his shochet, and this was right before Pesach. He said, prepare this bird for Pesach. And from that time on, the Muscovy duck has been treated as kosher in the land of Israel. And until very recently, until the production of foie gras, a fattened goose liver, which in Israel was always not goose, but duck, till that was banned, they were using ducks that were a hybrid of Muscovy and Pekin. And if they were using the children of Muscovy, obviously the Muscovy was being treated as kosher. And indeed, Rav Shiv Pesach Frank in the 50s discusses the Muscovy. He says, I'm not sure why it's mutter, but we're already treating it as permitted. Rav Shmuel Salant permitted it, and I'm not going to reverse that. So we have from Shmuel Salant, we have from Rav Shiv Pesach Frank, and we have from just a few decades, last decade, when the chief rabbi of Kiryat Shmona, his name is escaping me right now, and Rav Tzfania Drori, was giving hashkacha on the foie gras. So the Muscovy duck, a new world bird, in the United States was treated as not kosher, and the state in the land of Israel for almost over 100 years has been treated as kosher. The question, of course, came up again very recently. In 2010, it seems that there's a holiday in America that the non-Jews celebrate at the end of December. And at that holiday, they have a tradition to eat duck. So what happened was, there was a duck farm on Long Island that had run out of their usual Pekin duck when it came time to send the live ducks to the Satmar slaughterhouse. So they sent Muscovy ducks. The Satmar Shochtim had no clue the difference between a Pekin and a Muscovy. They slaughtered the Muscovy and they started selling those as kosher. Those who follow Jewish politics know that there are two different groups of Satmar today. Well, when the other group of Satmar got word that the first group had shechted and sold Muscovy duck, whoa, did they make hay out of it? Because more than that, they said, not only do we not have a tradition, but it's an absolute prohibited bird because of Doris. And they found online, this is my Hebrew translation, they found online a website, Muscovy Duck Central, where some woman who raises Muscovy ducks claims she saw a Muscovy duck being Doris baby chickens. And therefore they said, you guys of the other Satmar over there, it's mamish and min tome. It's an absolutely non-kosher species. Now, the problem is you could find descriptions like this from chickens as well. And we actually did an experiment. We're running out of time. We went to a duck farm here in Israel. We had them not feed their ducks for a day. We put out some baby chicks.
אתה מבין, זה מה שהם ראו, זה מה שהם ראו.
אם זה היו אפרוחים שלהם, הם לא
היו מנסויים אותם. מה שאני קוראים?
They were simply checking them out, and they didn't attack any of the birds. Anyhow, here's Shmuel Salant. He permitted the Muscovy duck in 1907, 1908, right before he passed away. And therefore, ever since then, it's been treated as prohibited in the U.S. and as permitted in Israel. So that's the story of another New World bird that had a very, very different trajectory to its kosher story than the turkey. Okay, we have 1 minute left for questions. Any questions?
Thank you. Just let me ask you very quickly, do the Satmar, half the Satmar eat it today?
No, they don't eat it. When they realized the mistake, they also went back. No. But they said at first they weren't going to require kashering. It's a suffix. It doesn't have a masorah. The other guys, though, were, let's see, a video for the chickens. They're acting like, correct, that's what you could find that. You're going to find reports like that of chickens. You'll find, but it doesn't mean if you have one such report.
Okay.
So
Rabbi, I'm waiting for you to have a picture of Rabbi Tendler eating swordfish.
Yeah, that's not happening.
Right. As you know, Ari has a phenomenal, has written the history of the kashrut of the swordfish, which basically was kosher, according to everybody, until 1951, I believe.
If what they call the dag cherev is what we call the dag cherev. The dag bal hacherev, you got to be precise how they called it, was treated as kosher around the Mediterranean basin until the 50s. Well, and actually, you know what? A different lecture, but also in New York, the Igor Arbonov in the 20s. Any questions about turkey, about Muscovy duck?
Yeah,
besides any of those exotic birds?
No, just that one question about the chicken doing that, I think. I don't see any others.
No, so the only thing with chicken, so there have been discussion about exotic breeds of chicken. And indeed, the rabbis of the 19th century dealt with certain kinds of chickens, with chickens with five toes, or if there were major significant differences between the physiologic or anatomic, between the chicken that we're used to and this other kind of chicken. So indeed, they would prohibit it. Recently, there was a big controversy regarding a type of chicken called the Brekel chicken, a big controversy here in Israel, where some people wanted to say that our chicken, the standard, is not kosher, only the Brekel was kosher. Others said the Brekel is not kosher and only ours is kosher. It seems that none of them have a significant differences, and they really all should be included under the rubric of the standard chicken Masorah. And if you're going to find some chicken that appears to be a Doris, I guess you can quote what Rav Soloveitchik said once about somebody's dog who ate some toothpaste on Shabbos, and they said, you see, it's Royal Achilles Caliph. And he said, maybe you have a dumb dog, a stupid dog. I don't know the exact language. But maybe there are chickens. I'm not going to tell you. Maybe there's a chicken who will act like a Doris. But we raise billions of chickens today, and it's clear that they're not predators. Anyhow, that's the story.
Thank you very much
We have a tradition on turkey. Many people know that Rav Soloveitchik used to eat turkey at his Thanksgiving dinner. So for all of those of you in America who are going to eat your turkey Thanksgiving dinner, enjoy and don't feel guilty at all.
Correct. Okay. Even in Canada. Okay. Right. Thank you. Thank you very much, Rav Ari. Okay, we'll let you go this evening, of course, the third of our triple header. Rabbi Daniel Karofkin of the Bayit here in Toronto will be giving our Parshat HaShavuah here. Everybody is welcome and the urge to attend. 8:30. He's currently the president of the Rabbinical Council of America. And hopefully we'll see 8:30. We'll see you next week. And okay, we look forward to learning with you. Please invite your friends to join us. And everybody have a wonderful day. And for those in America, happy Thanksgiving. Thank you very much. And thank you, Rav Ari.